Like Ma Bell, I have the ill communications. It's the Saftacast, and I'm your host, Scott C. Folks, the winter holidays are now pretty much over with, and we are back to our regularly scheduled programming on this show, and we have got some great stuff lined up for you over the next 6 months. I don't want to give it away, but we're talking some on-site, not Florida studio interviews, non-internet interviews. We've got some other mini episodes coming out. We had some great success with that one. We're looking forward to some other great stuff. I don't want to give it all away, so I'm not going to. You're just going to have to keep listening to the program, and believe me, we thank you for that. We do thank all of our fans and supporters of this show. If you want to be a fan and support something that I think is a worthy cause, well, let me tell you a little bit about Outspoken from Sundress Academy for the Arts. Now, I've mentioned it on the show before, but let me tell you about it again if you're not familiar with it. I think one of Sundress's most noble efforts is this project, the Outspoken Movement, which is a chance to address issues that are pertinent and very important to LGBTQ youth in not just Knoxville, not just Tennessee, but the South in general. And once again, they are doing workshops for LGBTQ youth, and they're hosting workshops for LGBTQ artists and writers beginning on January 17th, that is this week, but they're having other ones too, February 21st and March 28th. If you want to be a part of this, then drop on over to the Sundress Publications website at sundresspublications.com/outspoken/workshops.htm and be a part of it. If you cannot be there, but you still want to be a part of it and contribute to it, you can donate through a tax-deductible donation on that same page. It'll link you right over to the Sundress store where you can purchase a donation and help out LGBTQ writers, artists, performers, and students. I think it's a worthy cause. I do. Speaking of worthy causes, our guest today is invested in climate change and saving trees. And it sounds like it would be boring the way I just put it, but trust me, it's not. Chris Petrocelli is on the program. He's a fine writer, fine poet, but he is also a tree scientist. He studies tree rings. And while that may sound boring, trust me, it's not. We get into a lot of conversations here on the program today. It's a kind of a very esoteric conversation in a way. Not only do we find out why tree rings are important and what they can tell us, but we also learn strategies for board games. We learn about video games. We both reveal secrets from our past, and we have a conversation about swearing as well. And one of the biggest questions we pose at the end is, can you use the swear word shit as a conjunction or perhaps even a preposition? I don't know. We didn't come to a conclusion, but we're going to open it up to you, the listener. Give us a shout-out on our comments on Twitter. You can find us at Saftacast, or you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/Saftacast. Let us know in our comments there on the page or on our Twitter feed. Give us an example. Can you use that vulgarity, shit, as a conjunction or a prepositional phrase or a preposition word? I don't know. We'll give you some time here to think about it as you listen to Chris and I talk about a whole number of things. It's a great interview. Buckle up, because it's going to be fun. But first, since we're no longer in the holidays, let's listen to our normal theme song. Chris, how you doing, man?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, of course. Happy to be on.
Cool. You sound like you're in an echo chamber.
Shit, do I?
Yeah. No, not like sound quality. It sounds like you're standing in a wide room.
I'm in my lab, so that could probably be fucking with the sound. It's in the basement. It's kind of sketch. Do you need me to move?
No, that's totally fine. I was just curious. It's like you sound like you're in a very empty room right now.
It's not terribly empty. It's kind of cavernous. It's not empty, but cavernous. I'll say that.
Okay. So anyway, before we get really rolling here, I always have to ask the burning question that is on everybody's mind. You ready for it?
Sure.
All right. Being that you're a geographer.
Right.
Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
You know, it's one of those things, Scott. We're not allowed to, unless you're part of the club, we can't really discuss that.
Damn it.
I know. It's a burden that we all bear. You know, we enter a blood pact upon entering the profession. It's kind of like an unbreakable vow. And I don't value my life so completely, but I'd hate to see the loss of life for others, so I can't disclose that information.
I totally get it. I totally understand. I'm part of a fraternity. I'm bound by certain rules. I can't say things about things.
You know, they did some weird things to me.
Yeah, once the scars heal and everything, it's all good.
Yeah, maybe it could be like a rosebud moment, like when I'm on my deathbed, I'll let you know.
Okay, you're like dying and be like, Utah.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And none of us will know what you were talking about either.
Yeah, and then we'll be really messed up as you guys just end up burning her. How terrible is that?
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow.
It's under a big W.
Yeah, or maybe X marks the spot. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know, but it's good to know that that's secret information and it's protected well then.
It's in good hands, yeah.
So, Chris, I find it fascinating. You know, part of the reason I wanted you on the show is that you are a writer.
Mm-hmm.
You're a poet, but you are not from the vein of poetry and writing life that many of our other guests have been from.
Right.
I mean, you didn't go in as an English major necessarily and, you know, going for an MFA or things like that.
That's true. Originally, when I was going to Tennessee, I entered undeclared with interest in English education and then the opportunity to work in a tree ring lab, dendrochronology, fell into my lap my freshman year at University of Tennessee. So I've been doing that ever since. So yeah, the English thing was not at the forefront. I've studied trees.
How did that just fall into your lap?
Well, I took the easy way out for my college credits, which is what usually a lot of people do, I think, when they study or get into geography, right? Like, it's like you have to take science requirements. So instead of taking bio or chem, you could take geography at the University of Tennessee. And I was like, oh, fuck yeah. Like, that'll be super easy. Oh, I just dropped an F-bomb.
That's okay. I don't give a fuck.
I got a funny story about F-bombs, but that'll be for later. So yeah, like instead of just taking bio or chem, I took geography. And the person who was teaching the class was a PhD student. And he was just like, I need help with somebody processing my samples. I wanted to do something different and I volunteered. And that was that.
And that's how you started on the road to geography.
Yep.
So like when you were a child and everything, you weren't like obsessed with maps or anything. And it wasn't a lifelong thing that just suddenly bubbled to the surface.
True. Yeah, I was not. Well, yeah, I won't say I was obsessed with maps, but I was definitely interested in maps. I had this really awesome globe that I got from my grandfather. I have no idea when it was made. It's ass old. It still has West Africa as French West Africa on the globe. The thing is dated. Really cool. But yeah, no like obsession with maps or like, you know, I wasn't even like an outdoorsy kid. I couldn't say like, oh, I loved hiking and I loved being outdoors. It wasn't even that.
So you weren't like in the Boy Scouts or anything?
No, definitely. I was in this thing called, this is probably going to sound really fucked up now, total appropriation of culture. In Connecticut, there was this, what's it? It's Boy Scouts, right? There's this Boy Scouts-esque thing called Indian Guides, where it was the same exact thing. And I was in that for a while. And instead of earning badges, you earn feathers for your headdress. And looking back on it now, really just kind of weird and gross and almost disturbing because it's a bunch of white folk doing it.
Yeah, I'm getting a little icky from about that, you know?
No, it is. It's super icky, really icky. And like, you know, I was like, how old was I when I was doing it? I was like 5 or so when I got started and then, or maybe 6, I don't know. And then did it for a few years and then stopped. But yeah, really, really troubling now that I think about it, which I haven't thought about that in a while. But yeah, never did Boy Scouts, never did any of that stuff. I played a lot of video games. That was my thing. So yeah, the whole geography thing was just completely by chance.
My fresh air was made of pixels.
Your fresh air was made of pixels?
Pixels. P-I-X-E-L.
Pixels or pickles, you know, whatever works.
I don't know. I've never tried to breathe pickle brine.
Yeah, I've never tried that either. Although, yeah, you know, when you are a gamer, it's like a lot of Mountain Dew, a lot of Balls energy drinks, and I don't know, Cheetos, whatever your poison is.
One of the Eto's when it comes to snack foods.
Right, really, you know, it's like it's a pyramid. It's one of the doctors, one of the Itos, and I don't know. There's got to be a third thing. I don't even know.
A green type soda.
Oh, green type soda for sure. Yes.
It has to come in a green bottle and be green.
Yeah, you can't. None of that fake shit where the bottle's just green. The liquid itself definitely needs to be green or weird like piss green color. The only two that I'll allow in my mouth is get weird.
And really bad pizza. You can't forget like the $5.99 deal at like Little Caesars or something.
You know, you say bad pizza, but like, is it really bad if it's delicious? That's what I don't understand. You know, here's the deal. Over the holidays, I was just up in Connecticut visiting my family, and there's a whole style of pizza called it's New Haven style pizza, and Pepe's Pizza is the big name, and we always go there when we're home for the holidays. And as we're going to Pepe's Pizza, my brother Mario, he's like, "Yeah, man, you know, people will wait for like hours out the door, lines out the door for this pizza." And their famous one is their like white pizza, the clam sauce pizza, clam pizza. You know, we get in there, there's no line, and we're sitting down, and we eat it. And it's just fucking pizza. It's fine. You know, you're paying good money for it. People are waiting out the door when we're leaving. There's like a line. You're gonna wait 2 hours for a damn pizza. I don't know. It was weird. It was. I don't get it anymore. I don't get the whole like New York style pizza reigns supreme. New Haven style pizza's the shit. You know what, man? It was fine. It was fine.
What makes it New Haven? I've never heard of New Haven style.
Yeah, I asked my brother about it. Apparently, it's the type. It's like it has something to do with the crust. It's like a thin crust pizza, and it's apparently the way they cut it is funky, or something, or some bullshit. And there's probably other stipulations. I don't really know. I'm not a pizza guru. My brother Mario is though. He has this funny tattoo and this funny story. I think he was in Baltimore and at a tattoo convention. Him and his buddy George ordered a pizza and they were like talking shit on it, like how just bad it was. And then somebody was like overheard them or was listening to them, and then drew up this tattoo design for my brother Mario, and it was the image of the Sacred Heart, right? So like the heart and the crown of thorns bleeding with like the fire behind it and all that. It was that image, but with a slice of pizza instead of a heart with the crown on and everything. And so he got it tattooed on him while he was
Just the
there.
heart.
Yeah, just the slice of pizza as the heart with like the crown and the thorns and like the fire burning behind it. It's awesome.
That is pretty damn cool.
Total sacrilege. I love it.
I've never had a problem with blasphemy.
Now, blaspheming, it's the way to be. I mean, it's really the only way to pheme is blasting. Blaspheming is the best, I
I always
think.
find it fascinating. I don't know what your comedy background is, but I find it fascinating that the British can get away a lot more in their comedy with making fun of religion than Americans can.
Do they?
You watch Monty Python and such, they are, just full on attack at times on the, say, the Anglican Church and such. But Americans, you try doing that on cable television? Well, maybe not on cable, but on network? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be an uproar.
You know, I've never like really looked into it or studied it, but I'm seeing what you're saying. Yeah, I get it. I mean, I don't know, the Bible Belt's a wild place, man.
Anyway, so now I'm curious. You're born in Connecticut. That's where you're from originally?
Yeah, born in Connecticut, lived there till I was 14, and then we moved down to Greenville, Tennessee, which is eastern Tennessee at the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. Oh man, it was wild. I was such a shithead when we moved too. I hated it, or I acted like I hated it. I tried to full, just like outright reject it. But grew to love it. The South's awesome. I prefer the Southeast now to the Northeast. I think the Northeast kind of wigs me out. It's weird.
Do you consider yourself a Southerner now?
No, not at all. The thing about that, like the whole place identity thing, I struggle. I don't know if it's the right word. I wrestle with that a lot. But seeing like how my family is, my brothers especially, and like the ties they have to the Northeast, and just the knowledge they have of their area and where they're from, it's really in depth. And I long to have that sort of knowledge of place, but I don't have that with the Northeast because I never really got to know it. I moved away too young. I rejected the Southeast when I lived there for like the first year or two, and when I tried to claim the South, I didn't feel like that was something I could do because I felt like an outsider. While I was there, I didn't feel like it was mine to be a part of. I felt like I just showed up too late. And so I want, as much as I want to own it, I don't feel like I'm allowed to. And now I'm in the Midwest, and I don't think anybody wants to own the Midwest, so it could go fuck itself.
Depends on the Midwest, where you're from.
I guess, that's true, yeah. I mean, you know, I talk so much shit on the Midwest, but it's actually really nice. People here are pretty great, and it's not too bad. It's kind of nice.
I know Minnesotans, people from Minnesota, are very proud they're from Minnesota.
You know, does that count, though? I mean, like, that's nice. That's nice, like, northern... I don't know. Isn't it, like, just nicer up there?
I don't know. I haven't been to Minnesota.
I've never been either.
We'll be going to spring, but...
Oh, yeah. Minneapolis for AWP.
Yeah, I will be there. At least Aftercast will make a showing.
Oh, nice. That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't really... One of my really good friends is from St. Paul, so that's cool.
Yeah. Twin Cities.
Yep. Twin Cities. What else good comes out of St. Louis? Or St. Louis.
I don't know about St. Louis.
Yeah, St. Louis. That's not even... I meant to say, was it St. Paul, right? Yeah. No, St. Louis is cool, too. Isn't Nelly from St. Louis?
I'd have to check, but you might be right.
Well, we got Nelly. St. Louis also has its own style of pizza. I believe there's... Or I think there's this place called Emo's Pizza that does cracker crust and puts this weird cheese, don't know what kind... on their pizza. And I think Emo's is from St. Louis. All my Midwest friends are going to fucking gang up on me and basically talk about how bad I misrepresented the region. But yeah, Emo's Pizza, they do like cracker crust. I've had it once.
And they make you slice your wrists instead of the pizza.
It's true. Yeah, it's they have the strangest cutting style of all. You know, and which sucks is because then you slice your wrist. They don't even slice the pizza, so you're eating the thing whole. And you can barely hold it up. It's impossible.
It's Emo's Pizza. That's why. You just sit there and you pine over your lost loves and unrequited girlfriends and such. And you end up cutting yourself instead of the pie.
Yep. And then you put the mascara and the eyeliner on and you got your pizzas all turned black by the end of it. It's terrible.
Do you want Cure or Snow Patrol on your pizza?
Is Snow Patrol emo? They are, aren't they?
I don't know.
I don't know.
It just popped in my head because I think they're the ones that do that song of... let the world go by or whatever it is. I forget.
I don't know. I don't know either. Snow Patrol. That's hilarious. I haven't thought of Snow Patrol since, like, I don't know, 2009. Shit.
I'm trying to think what other emo bands were there, because I know the style and I know it's mocked, but for the life of me, I can't name you five emo bands.
Wouldn't you call Conroe Burst emo? Like, let's be real, right?
Maybe.
Come on.
I mean, the Smiths and Morrissey can technically be considered emo, but I kind of put Morrissey in his own category.
He gets his own category, but if he ain't emo, then I don't know what is.
Yeah, it's like maybe Ted Leo and the Pharmacists?
What? I don't even know what that is.
I don't know. I seem to remember their name. I don't even know. See, this is how far removed I am from the emo culture.
Yeah, you know, when I was in high school, I was one of those... I wasn't an emo kid. I wasn't a scene kid, but I was pretty damn close. I definitely rolled with those people.
What did you consider yourself as in the high school spectrum?
I don't know, man. My high school was kind of... I had it good in my high school. You know, it was definitely clicky, but like all the cliques... I mean, I don't know. I permeated. I don't think I was necessarily ever part of one thing. I mean, I definitely was. I rolled with... but they weren't overly seen kids. I don't know. It was just I just felt like a person.
Never labeled yourself?
Nah, you know, I didn't roll with that. I was definitely not a jock.
Were you
not that there's anything wrong with that, but I was never jacked nor played sports.
Were you ever interested in sports?
Dude, I wasn't interested in sports until like college. I did want to play football when I got into high school, but then we moved. That's the thing. We moved from Connecticut to Tennessee right as I was going to my freshman year of high school. So not only the culture shock, but then like from going from the Northeast metropolitan New York area down to, you know, Appalachian foothills, but also like it's right as you're going into high school. That sucked. So I didn't even bother trying to play foosball. I was kind of terrified that like all the kids would be like super gigantic and like ungodly strong, and like, you know, like you think of like, I think of Southern football and all I think of is like Friday Night Lights type shit. It was nothing like that, but I still never ended up playing football.
A whole different football culture in the Northeast.
Is there one? You know what I mean?
There is. You're from Connecticut, so you were caught between the Patriots and the Giants.
Yeah, well, our family's diehard Giants fans, so.
So there you go. There's a little bit, and in the early 90s, Buffalo, my team, was the hot shit.
Yeah, you know, it's different. It's different when it's professional football versus high school, college football, though, you know?
Outside of a couple I can think of in the Northeast, there's not much in the way of college football there. You don't hear much of them running for championships.
No, no way in hell. Like, God, it's kind of sad when the hottest thing is, like, Ivy League football.
The only two teams I can think of offhand that have had good success in the Northeast, Boston College and Syracuse.
Yeah, BC's pretty good. I mean, a couple years ago, I remember UConn was around, but not really. I hear their games are fun to go to, though. This is difficult for me to admit as a Vols fan, but I was really heartbroken the other week when they lost, only because I really wanted the SEC to be represented in the national championship game. So I'll root for whoever, with the exception of Florida. I will never root for University of Florida. Oh shit, you're from Florida. I don't know if
no,
you have
I'm
any.
Not.
Well, you're not from Florida, but you live in Florida, right?
That doesn't make me a Gators fan.
Okay, I was nervous. I wasn't sure if there was going to be an affiliation just by association, by proximity sort of thing.
No, Chris, I married into an LSU family.
Oh, that's right. I forget about that. Go Tigers.
I have to stay in that side of the fence. Otherwise, I am kicked out.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Yeah, I forgot about that affiliation.
So you move to the South, and you go to UT, obviously.
Yeah, yep.
So how did you wind up in the Midwest then?
So while I was at the University of Tennessee, I ended up working in the laboratory of tree ring science while I was there. All 3.5 years that I was there, I was involved in any and all projects in that lab. And so my research interest evolved around dendrochronology, which is cool when you break it down. It's the study of tree time. And so, you know, there's only a few labs and only a few people to study with. And there's a researcher here at the University of Missouri, Dr. Grant Elliott, who does research in the tree line ecotone, which is where, you know, the forest grows up the mountain and then it stops, and that's the tree line essentially. And he studies in the Rocky Mountains, and I just thought it would be really cool to continue my research there. I applied here. My friend Grant Harley started a tree ring lab up at the University of Southern Mississippi, actually, and I applied there. And then I also applied to the University of Tennessee as well as Appalachian State. I just got the best deal at the University of Missouri, so I came here. And also, my partner at the time was going to school out here, so it was like a win-win. So that's what brought me out here, is just research.
Okay, so what is cool about cutting trees down and looking at their rings?
Oh, well, Scott, that is where you are mistaken. We do not cut the trees down.
How do you see the rings?
Well, it's actually really cool. We take this thing called an increment borer, which is basically, imagine like a hollowed-out drill bit that's operated manually. And so we take this this increment borer, you press it to the base of a tree, and then you crank it by hand into the tree, and then you keep turning, you drill to the center of the tree, and you insert an extractor, which I like to call a spoon, crank it out a couple times, you pull the spoon out, and then sitting in the spoon, there will be a nice, what we call a tree ring core. So it's just a small little bit of the tree that you're taking out of it, and you store it in a tube, and then you take it back to the lab for processing it. However, there is at times you do have to do destructive sampling, so sometimes you do have to cut down some seedlings and saplings. But your ecological impact is very small, minute.
Sounds to me almost like tapping a tree for sap, for maple syrup.
You know, kinda. Yeah, it's pretty close. And you know, people are always like, well, you drilled a hole into the tree. Doesn't that mess with it? Not really, because, like, the tree will heal itself. Just, like, blood will clot a wound. The sap will clot the hole. Or you could insert a plug if need be, if there's, like, a breakout in the area. But, you know, you won't be doing that. So that's what we do. And then, you know, you take it back to the lab. You sand down the tree ring cores. And then you cross-date the years of the rings. And then it tells you all cool sorts of cool ecological information.
Like what? I'm not in this world and everything, and I'm not dumping on you saying what you're doing is a waste of time. Not at all. But enlighten me. What could you learn from the tree rings?
Right. So I'll tell you some multiple applications. You can, if you're doing like paleoclimate studies, because tree rings are responsive to climate variables such as temperature and precipitation, you can use that to study past climates and reconstruct climate conditions in the past, is one thing you could do. My research is specifically looking at climate vegetation interaction at the tree line ecotone. And so since these trees are growing at like the upper forest border on top of a mountain, they're really sensitive to changes in climate. So we're testing how is climate change affecting these forests, affecting the rates of establishment at tree line. Is it more closely related to like temperature? Or is it more closely related to precipitation? Is it more complicated than that? And then how does like the landscape, how does the topography or the geographic orientation influence those climate inputs? That's what I'm doing now. But another really cool thing, and like that's the really sciencey stuff that's really cool.
And important, but, too, it sounds like. I mean, climate issues right there.
Yeah, climate issues, implications for climate change. You know, people study, you can study fire with them. There's like a lot of fire histories that are done. And so like when a fire burns through a forest, it leaves a scar on the tree, and then the tree can heal over that. So like when you sample those trees, you can see past fire scars as long as the tree has lived. So you can reconstruct intervals of fire and frequencies of fire to study how the landscape was experiencing fire, you know, however many hundreds of years ago, and how that's different today. And there's all sorts of implications for that. And like, you know, people use those studies to understand how to, you know, manage a forest, fire mitigation practices and everything. And then one of the cool things that I always talk to people about when they ask like, oh, what do you do with tree rings, that I think is really neat. When I was at the University of Tennessee, we took on a lot of archaeological projects. And so like you can go to houses or cabins and you can take cores from different parts of the house, like different cross beams and stuff. And if you have enough rings in those beams, you can run them against different what are called chronologies, so just different time series from different parts of the United States. And you can tell approximately like when that structure might have been built. So you can date cabins. What was really cool while I was at the University of Tennessee, if you take like violins, you can open them, or you can just scan the top of them and you could count those and measure those rings. And arguably you can like rule out dates of when that wood was, you know, collected and used to construct that instrument. And so we did shit like that. It was really neat.
That's like good for spotting counterfeits and such right there.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what people do with it. There was one time this dude, I don't really know anything about classical instruments, but this guy thought he had this really lucrative, famous, I don't know if I'm allowed to divulge this, but I'm just going to divulge it anyway. Thought he had this famous Guadagnini violin. And then we essentially ruled it out and was like, no, this ain't a Guadagnini. And then he got pissed off and went to somewhere else to see if it was a Guadagnini or not. And then I have no idea what happened after that. But another really cool thing is like several years ago, before I was involved with the lab at Tennessee, they brought a Messiah Stradivarius violin in and did the analysis on it, and it ended up that it was a Stradivarius, and there's all sorts of cool shit going on with that. So,
but everybody flipped out over that one.
Oh, totally. Yeah, man. How could you not? But yeah, I mean, so there's all sorts of implications. The my buddy down at USM, they found this really awesome sunken forest. It was in the news like last year, of all these preserved trees that were underwater off the coast of Mississippi, I guess, or in the Gulf of Mexico. So there's underwater forests, and they were going to collect samples from there and then try to reconstruct climate using the tree rings. You can also, oh man, another cool project I did was we tried to separate alpha cellulose from tree ring cores, which we did successfully by running them through a series of chemical washes. And then depending on the type of isotopes that are found in the tree ring, you can reconstruct like hurricane patterns in the tree ring record. So that was really neat. There's all sorts of cool shit, man. Yeah, it's great. It's cool stuff.
Shit, I feel kind of lame because, like, you know, all I do is look at it and go, wow, tree rings tell how old a tree is.
Yeah, it's like, oh, look, this thing's 100 years old. Yeah. Well, I mean, like, that is cool. The oldest tree, hold on, I have the record here somewhere. The oldest tree right now in our lab at Missouri dates back to currently 1602. Yeah, 1602. So the thing's old as dirt. So it goes back to the early 1600s. That's not even the center of the tree. It's just it's a bristlecone pine, and we weren't able to get all the way to the center of the tree. So yeah, 1602. This tree's seen some shit.
I'm about to say, yeah, that tree has seen some shit. If that tree could talk.
Right, yeah. Well, you know, if it could talk, it probably hasn't seen that much cool stuff because it is lonely on top of a mountain, so...
So it would be basically like going to visit your grandfather in a hospital. He's just telling you, when I was a little boy.
Right? Yeah, exactly. When I was a sapling.
When I was a sapling, this whole mountain was full of dirt.
Now there's a parking lot and a Walmart.
They tore down paradise and put in a parking lot.
Exactly.
And we're back to emo music.
Yeah, right. It's come full circle. It's full circle, Scott.
It has. Now I'm starting to wonder about the whole playing music for plants things, if that helps or not.
I don't know. Do people do that?
It was a big thing in the 70s.
I bet it was.
Yeah, the 70s, that explains it right there. But no, yeah. I think a book came out on it that you should talk to your houseplants and play music for them, and it will help them grow because they feed off human emotions.
Man, how bad does that suck, though, if you end up talking to your plant, really care for it, and then it just dies on you? That's tough.
I believe there has been some study, though, on the effects of conversation, the effects of certain types of music on plants, though, to see if it does increase. Because why not? Why not test that? Okay, let's see. Maybe it pans out to nothing, but let's at least give it a shot.
I mean, yeah, imagine if you didn't give it a shot, and then all this while, like, if you just did it, plants would, I don't know, grow exponentially. Yeah, everything's worth a shot, I think. There was this study I saw. It was an article on I Fucking Love Science. I didn't read the actual article, so I don't know the real science. But the headline was that plants can hear themselves being eaten.
Well then,
right, because it sends some sort of chemical, like when a plant's attacked, it sends some sort of chemical response throughout the plant or something or another. So some people were arguing or trying to say, like, oh, that shows something indicative of not sentience, maybe, but like whatever. But you know, that's some far fetched kind of whack ass idea, I think. But it's kind
of
cool.
Makes me think now of Mitch Hedberg and his joke: if fish could talk, the ocean would be loud and shit.
Yeah, you know? That's a good one. That's
if farms could talk, man, like corn would just be screaming all the time.
That or begging for you to talk to them. We, you know what? Fuck, can plants talk to each other? Whoa, that's wild. What are they planning?
Now we're starting to sound like we're stoned. Yeah, you know? Like, man, imagine if plants could talk to each other.
Yeah, this conversation has already taken so many turns.
Now I'm wondering about, like, if I eat a spinach salad, does the spinach know I'm eating it because it's already dead? Are we talking about plants that are still in the ground, or are we talking about a salad bowl here?
Yeah, if it's picked, is it still? Because, for instance, I left an onion on my table for 3 months. I didn't eat it, and I left it there because it started sprouting and growing just sitting on the table. And so I was like, this dude's a fighter. I'm going to keep him around. He's still there. He's still growing. He's looking good. He's got three really long green stems growing out of the top of them. So, I mean, I expected that thing to not be alive anymore. Maybe he's trying to communicate. He's reaching out.
Do you talk to him that often?
I don't address him directly. Him, her, I don't know. I don't address it directly, but it definitely hears me. I talk to myself a lot, so it definitely hears conversation.
I'm glad you explained that, too, because I was going to stop you and go, why did you leave an onion on your table for 3 months?
Here's the deal. I have a housemate, and I am just so weird, and a bunch of friends and family can vouch for this. I hate being an imposition, right? Anything I do feels like I'm imposing or being an imposition on somebody else. So if I ever am not sure that like something is mine or his, I don't eat it and I don't bother to ask him and I just let it go. And so this onion's been sitting there for months and neither of us have been eating it. I don't even know if it's still good because it started growing again, but this happens all too often and so much food just goes to waste and rot. I've started eating some of the food now, but like it comes out of my weird want to not be an imposition on people. So I just, you know, I'm just like, oh, I don't know if this is mine, so it's definitely his.
I'm curious where that comes from in you.
Man, I have no idea. I was a weird kid though.
Explain weird, because we're all weird kids in some way.
Right. Well, you know, my parents always tell me, like, I wouldn't stop crying for the first 2 years. My dad always tells me I was like a demon spawn child, and I just never stopped crying for like the first 2 years. And then, boom, one day, instantly, I just stopped crying. I stopped talking. I didn't respond to anybody, and I would just sit in front of a TV, zoned out, like, probably looked like some future murderous rampage. They don't say it like that, but that's how I imagined it. Whenever they explain the story, I just imagine, like, just some weird future, like, serial killer Dexter scenario. So from, like, crying incessantly to absolutely nothing until I was, like, 6 or 7. So just, you know, wholesale change. Like, that was fucking weird.
Did you get tested or anything? Did they, like, bring in doctors and be like, our son's not speaking?
Hell no, I didn't get tested. They just thought I was, like, a quiet kid. And then another thing is I didn't know how to read until, like, third grade. that's probably atypical for the rest of the writers that you interview, too. They probably all read them like fiends. I didn't know how to read until I was, like, 9. Yeah, I couldn't read. And I remember my mom always tells me – I don't remember this myself, but she tells me, like, I would play Super Mario 64, and I would never know – I always want to know what the story was. And I'd be like, Mom, read this for me. What's he saying? What's Mario saying? What's going on? And she'd be like, oh, no, honey, you got to read it yourself. You got to read it yourself. And that's how I learned how to read was video games. Dude. Oh, man. Oh, I sound like such a – it's so weird. So weird.
Not really. I mean, we all learned – I'm going to be honest with you. The way I learned to read was spite.
Oh, how was that?
So I'm a toddler, and my parents are visiting Gettysburg, the battlefield, and yeah. I'm like a 2-3 year old or so, and I want to get out and play. I want to roam. I want to run. And I couldn't. I'm in the back seat of a car, and I got so mad at them. And according, this is their version of the story, I threw a temper tantrum, and then I shut up. And about 15 minutes later, they hear this grumbling from the back seat. They turn around, and I had grabbed my Sesame Street dictionary and was reading it to them.
Oh, man.
I still have that copy of that book. It sits on our shelf here in a place of honor because it's so damaged and so old. But that's how I learned to read, according to them. I just spontaneously started reading.
That's brilliant. I love that.
So I was a weird kid, too.
Yeah, learning to read... Like so, like the methodology there was I'm gonna make them so just frustrated that I'm reading this dictionary that they let me out to play.
Exactly, I think that's what my mindset may have been was that this will make them mad.
Oh my god, that's
will make them sorry.
That's subversive and smart. Yeah, that's powerful. That is powerful shit.
I think maybe that's why I started going into English. I don't know.
Yeah, right. I wanted to control people.
I have no problem with that. That's the core of some of my pedagogy, actually.
Oh, Jesus. That's awesome.
Well, you read enough as it is, I'm sure.
Oh, man. Yeah, my friend Rudy would definitely disagree with that.
Why is that?
She's just always giving me shit about how I don't read. Thanks a lot, Ru.
I'm wondering then what her definition of reading is.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't. She refuses to accept my reading canon. I don't know. It's strange.
What do you read?
Well, nowadays, a lot of tree line articles and literature. But, I mean, the other day I picked up C.S. Lewis's Great Divorce. I've been in a constant struggle trying to read Cormac McCarthy's Citri. That brings back just, oh my God, that book it's phenomenally written. And it's about Knoxville. And it just brings back so many memories. Oh my God, it's so good. I don't know if it's because he's such a great writer. Well, it's definitely partly that, but his imagery is out of this world. Plus, I've been in like all those same scenarios, like blackout drunk in downtown Knoxville, covered in my own vomit. So I totally and he names the streets that he's on and shit. And I'm just boom, instantly there, reliving it. Oh, it's so wonderful. I read The Road was my first thing, which isn't fair and totally uncouth probably to start there because it was fine. But then I picked up Sutri, and so far my mind's just blown. But yeah, I don't know. I read. I'm also a big fan of children's lit, you know, which everybody shits on me for. Not everybody. A lot of people shit on me for. I'm like, whatever, bro. Children's lit's the shit.
Depends on the children's lit.
Totally depends on the. Yeah, I won't make that general blanket statement for all children's lit. But I don't know. Like, I don't read a lot, but I read enough.
So what do you do in your off time then? If you're not reading, do you still play video games?
Not as much as I want to, but I'm a huge fan of the Civilization series. Oh my god, so good. Sid Meier's Civ. I play that on occasion. I'm also, I hate admitting this, but since it's been break, you know, for the past couple weeks and I got another week of it, I've been playing incessantly NCAA football 2012. I took University of Wyoming, which is one of the worst teams you could be, and I've done a dynasty mode and I've coached there from 2012 to 2033 in the game. So that's like 21 plus seasons. I've taken them from one of the worst teams in all of college football to national championship contenders, and we actually won it in 2032, and we're going for a repeat in 2033. So I'm proud of the team. We made it.
I did that with Madden once. Back when in Madden you could create your own team.
Oh,
and
yes.
Stick them into the NFL, and then they got rid of that feature, I think, in like 2004, 2005.
Why would you ever get rid of that?
I don't know. I think that's great. It's like, yeah, I kicked out. I think it was the Baltimore Ravens I kicked out.
Oh, nice.
And I supplanted them with the Richmond Generals.
That's sweet. What were your colors?
We were teal and yellow.
Oh, my God. That is so great. Are you serious?
Yeah, we had teal and yellow, and our helmet was one of the pre-designed logos of three stars and a sword. And I'm like, well, that's kind of general-like. So, and
oh, my God. That is fantastic. Holy shit, man.
I actually created a yearbook for a couple of seasons where I would take screenshots and then I put them into MS Word and told the story of what was going on at the time.
That's the most beautiful, passionate thing I've ever heard.
Create a whole story about me. I was tight end, and there was a whole thing about our coach, I think, was the one who would constantly eat soup furiously.
Why?
I don't know, but that was our coach's thing on the sidelines, is he would just sit there and eat soup.
Oh my god, that's awesome. Did you guys ever win the Super Bowl?
Yeah, because we changed all the options and everything, so we decimated everybody.
It's just max stats?
Yeah, well, not max stats, but like certain penalties were off, certain advantages to our team.
Yeah, yeah.
Civilization, though.
Yeah, Civilization is just a fun game. You pick a Civ, play as a Civ, you start from like X thousands years BC and just like discover new tech, settle new cities, engage in warfare, all this stuff. And it's a simulation turn-based game. It takes forever to complete a single round, but it's just like the most in-depth, like one of the funnest things I've ever done. Like almost every decision you have has consequences in game. Another cool game like that where everything you decide matters. I've always been a big fan of the Fable series. So good. Fable 1, by far, one of the most groundbreaking RPGs, was great. Fable 2 is the best. And I need to say this now. It is a disgusting fact, but I'm ashamed to have it out in the world. I have clocked over 151 hours of playing Civilization 5.
That's not that bad.
Is that not that 151 hours? I mean, that's just kind of gross. And then I've also clocked over 120 hours each of playing Elder Scrolls 4, Oblivion, and Elder Scrolls 5, Skyrim on just one character for each.
How long have you had the games? That's a big question.
Well, that's a good thing. I've had Civ 5 for maybe a year. And then the Elder Scrolls games, I don't even know. I mean, I've owned those for a while, but like I don't still play those, but when I got them, man, you know, you just sit down, you play for like 4 hours at a time.
I know. I got Skyrim this summer, and for about 6 months there, I played it pretty well. I clocked 166 hours on it.
Oh, shit. Okay, so I don't feel too bad.
Do you want the scary one, though? I'm looking at it right now on Steam. Is I picked it up, started playing in 2009. I've clocked 831 hours on Team Fortress 2.
Oh, my God. What?
Yeah. Half of that time is what's called idling, where you're not actively playing and you're just kind of sitting there racking up items and such.
Right, you got like macros running or not?
Yeah, so we're gonna say about 400 hours. Never cheating. I never cheated in that game, but never.
Right, right. All right, cool. Well, I feel great now. I feel wonderful.
But I ask you about Civ because on the last day of the Steam sale, a friend of mine gifted me on Steam Civ 4.
Oh man, Civ 4. That was a really good one. There's definitely a lot of educational material in the game. One of the things I like about Civ or that I thought was interesting was this semester when I was teaching, and I mentioned we were talking about the importance of rivers in Europe and like how rivers act as like industrial zones, commerce zones, this, that, the other thing, and how important they are for like transportation and like how important they are for cultural advancement and everything. And one of the things that I ended up saying to my students was like, you know what? Everybody go home, buy Civilization 5, and then you'll understand the importance of rivers. So it's like, yeah, I don't know. It's really interesting to see that like you can see like the way like landscape and natural resources definitely have influenced and impacted like civilization throughout millennia. It's awesome.
Definitely that, and things like diplomacy.
Oh, totally.
You have to learn some civics and ethics in there.
You do. I feel like such a scumbag because I'll always be really buddy-buddy with somebody, and then like once we discover coal or oil and I don't have any, I'm like, sorry, dude, I'm bombing you. And then I take it from them. So don't ever elect me to world supreme leader, and watch out for my ents in the future because I'm coming for you.
I would hate to play against you in Risk, I think.
Oh, man. You know what, though? Here's the thing. It's different when you play. I've never played Civ online with other people. I've only played against computer opponents. And it's also different, I think, like if you're doing tabletop gaming or even online gaming, if you were playing Civ 5, something that requires strategy and everything, it's different when you have, you know, when you're not playing against a computer. If I was playing with other people, I doubt I would be such a shithead because it's easier and just different working out deals with another person than it is like a computer, you know?
You don't feel bad about hacking a game.
No, no, not at all. Not at all.
But cheating another person, that's different.
Yeah, because then, you know, there becomes some sort of, you know, ethical or just like a real emotional tie to the performance, I guess.
In Monopoly, I have a very good friend of mine who is the devil. And it's one of those people who will be like, you don't need that get out of jail free card. It's not doing you any good. Now, if you were to sell that to me, I could help you out with the light blue properties here because you notice that I have Connecticut Avenue. We can work something here with this.
Yeah, so he trades you a light blue for the get out of free jail card?
He'll pull deals like that. And at first you resist, but he showed me and helped me figure it out. We developed a style of Monopoly that we call Shotgun Monopoly, where all of us roll at the same time, all of us move at the same time, all of us are paying rent at the same time. You play like a four-hour game in 1 hour then.
That sounds impossible to manage.
It requires in-depth knowledge of the game board and the cards and knowing everything. But you get about halfway through that, and you're forced to make deals. There's no way out.
Yeah.
You have to start cutting deals with people and being like, all right, listen, I'm going to let you go after the States Avenue and that property board right there if you can give me Marvin Gardens on that one.
Dude, that is some grifting going on, huh?
Oh, it's brutal. And, you know, I know the statistics. I was actually talking with another writer right before Christmas this year. I was playing Monopoly against a computer. And my wife can vouch for this because I just cheered. One of the best games I've ever had against a computer. I'm down against the computer like 10,000 to like 1,500 on me.
Dang.
And they had Boardwalk and Park Place. Hotels.
It's over.
Oh, no, it's not. Because I looked at it and I went, I own the red properties and three of the railroads. Watch this. 20 minutes later, me, 10,000, them, 3,000.
Oh, snap.
I know statistics.
From owning the red properties and three railroads you land on one, was that like 175, 150?
That's 100.
100? Oh, dang.
No, statistically speaking, the most landed on properties in the entire game are the red ones.
Really? So that's Kentucky Ave, right?
Kentucky, Illinois, and Indiana.
Okay, yep.
You lock those down, you've got a fair shot at winning.
Well, now that I know that, I'm definitely going to employ this strategy in the future. Yeah, well, how do you feel about the utility companies? Those are probably not even worth it, right?
They're fun to trade with a computer because the computer thinks that they're valued because it's a monopoly.
Right.
And I'm like, you realize it's the shittiest one in the whole game. The highest you can make on it is 240.
Yeah, because it's also, the utilities are predicated on the dice roll, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you play the rule you land on go, you get 400 bones?
No, we play the. I play the straight rule. The only rule I wish that the computer had and it doesn't have in the program is the free parking rule, where every time you get a chance card or something, it's like, you know, you lose $50. You put under free parking.
Yep, yep. Yeah, that's a good rule.
I love Monopoly. I'd say that that's my favorite board game.
Yeah, Monopoly's great. You ever play Settlers of Catan?
Actually, I have never played that.
Oh, we get into some furious... My friend Emma, holy shit, she always wins. And the only time I think I ever beat her was last year on my birthday. And I remember as we're playing, I'm like, Emma, if I end up winning this round, this game doesn't count because it's my birthday and I know you let me win, and I end up winning. And so I recuse myself from the victory, and I've still yet to beat her in Catan, like a year and a half into our friendship. She's a mastermind. If you like Monopoly, you know, you don't own property per se, and you don't really trade properties, but you trade like the resource cards. It's fun. Now we get into some fights over Monopoly.
If I come to Missouri, then I will have to join you in Settlers of Catan or something.
Dude, please hit me up. We'll definitely get down and dirty with it.
And we'll see if my Monopoly dealings versus your civilization dealings can cancel each other out.
You know, if there was warfare involved, you know, then my then my strategy might be cool. But there's no warfare involved, so maybe we just gotta play Risk.
Maybe.
Yeah, that sounds like a hellhole.
You don't really need Greenland.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just sitting there. It's acting as an access point that will allow me to get in and take Toronto and the Ontario province.
I just always got to roll. You got to take Australia.
No.
What? Island Kingdom? Just massive force build up in Australia and then just take over the world, right? Isn't that how that works?
Yeah, problem with that, though, is there's only two egress points out of Australia unless you play expanded rules.
Oh, okay.
So you're just building up and everything, and it's not worth it. I find that for the amount of reinforcements you get per turn is so low, it's only two, it's not worth it versus taking North America, which only has three access points and gives you five.
That's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, the cost-benefit analysis on North America is the crucial one.
Yeah, for real. The CBA is wild. Man, I can't believe we're talking tabletop gaming strategies. This is awesome.
Welcome to the SAFTAcast.
Yeah. We really don't talk about writing. This is great.
We really don't. In fact, our slogan, I think, for AWP, we're going to have a shirt that's made that just says, "Your writing doesn't matter."
That's so great. That's awesome. I definitely need one of those.
We'll see how much I piss people off at that conference with it.
Yeah, I'm gonna copy that strategy and wear one to the AAG, which is the geography conference, that says, "Your research fucking sucks." See how that does. Wear it during my talk.
Especially when they look at you and be like, "Well, you look at tree rings."
Right? Yeah, I'll get shit all over. It's so great. Yeah, yeah, joke's on you. I'm raising a tree army. Later, fool.
I'm talking to the king of the Ents right now. It's all good.
The dude that comes up to me and disses me is the first to die. So for everybody that listens to this, don't diss me unless you want to die by tree. I can't believe I just made a threat to the listeners. That's awesome.
That's why I do this show.
I'm never coming back. Sorry, Scott.
That's all right. Gonna go off and be with the trees now.
You know, they're the only ones that accept me.
Does anyone ever call you a tree hugger?
I got some family members that do it in jest. Nobody ever really calls me a tree hugger, though. I've never been called such. Nobody's done it with mal intent, I guess.
Maybe that should be your shirt then.
What's the shirt?
Go ahead, call me a tree hugger.
You know, maybe, yeah. I mean, I've been called a hippie before and stuff, but yeah, never tree hugger. I don't know, like do people even use that as an insult anymore? Really? I mean, I don't know. I'll take it though, tree hugger. That's a good title.
Eh, kind of, sort of, you know, tree borer.
Whoa! Now that's that has other connotations that I'm actually all right with. Actually, this is kind of funny. So like when you're pulling the increment bore out, so like you've already drilled all the way in, you've already extracted the core. It's fucking hard because it's a living organism, right? That you're drilling this thing into manually by hand. So like after the first three, your shoulders, your chest, and your arms are just sore as shit, and you got to do it pretty quick because like you're drilling into a living thing. So the mass around the borer is, you know, being pushed away. And then if you leave it in there too long, all of that will start to reconstrict around the bore. So you've got to like lean back and drill out in reverse. And you're doing it all manually, doing it so quick, and there's so much friction. Wow, this is getting really, really awesome. So much friction on the inside of the tree that when the borer comes out, it'll actually be so hot that it'll be smoking. And
that's never happened to me before.
Yeah, well, it's an experience. You know, it takes some skill, a lot of turning. But so like when the borer comes out, it's smoking, and then like we always used to, or it was at one field excursion. Somebody one time was like, oh, man, you know, so-and-so smoking rods. And so I always wanted to get, like, a tattoo of an increment borer with, like, the like an old-style American tattoo with the banner below it that just says smoking rods on my bicep. I thought that would be so awesome.
And then, you know, it just – it appears as you're doing the work and everything. It's just your sleeve rolls up a little bit.
So good. So good. I would love that. Smoking rods.
You get 10 – you get tenure one day, you get that. And that way, yeah. Your students or anything, you're doing the work with them and you show them how it's done, that thing pops up, you're like, yeah, motherfucker, I've been there.
Oh, that's so right, man. Yo, you kids don't know nothing about rods.
Yo, you're using those laser things.
Yeah, that'll be the thing. By the time I'm teaching, if it ever comes to that, yeah, there's this like new method and I'm still smoking my rods.
Exactly. So if they're like, yeah, why is Dr. Petrocelli always, you know, just standing by laughing at us? You know, he should be out here doing it. That's when you show him the tattoo and be like, fuck you.
Exactly. Yeah, telling my students to go fuck themselves. Yeah.
I was smoking rods when you were at your mother's teat.
Yeah. Oh, man. So violent. I like it. Dang it.
Well, what else are you going to – you got to somehow make your job seem really more awesome to those who are not in that world.
Right, that's so true.
Because otherwise you get those looks of like, so what do you do with trees?
You know, the best thing I do is like people are like, so what do you do? And I'm like, oh, you want to know what I do? I literally get paid to drink coffee, read, and hike the Rocky Mountains. And so like that's my ultimate like fuck you if anybody asks with like a tone of like, you know, holier than thou, high horse, like, oh, you study trees. I'm like, no, I get paid to drink coffee, read, and hike. So, you know, how's your day going?
So I'm willing to bet then you've become a bit of an expert hiker now.
I wouldn't say expert hiker, but yeah, we spent 3 weeks in Colorado, you know, camping and hiking, sleeping, living at, you know, above 8,000 feet, 9,000 feet. The highest we camped was around 11,000 feet, and it was intense. Oh my God. Literally intense and intense as well. Yeah, it was a beautiful thing, and just so great camping out in that environment. It got down to like freezing some nights, and it was like the middle of the summer. What's really cool about being out west where there's like no light pollution, you're on top of a mountain, you can see like satellites all night long.
Damn.
Just whizzing through the sky. Oh, it's so great. It's one of the most beautiful experiences of my life. Yeah, it was great. And then I remember one day, me and my advisor at this tree line site, just scouting, seeing if it was worth, you know, studying, making sure that it was in fact a climate controlled tree line. And we were like, dude, we're like so close to the top of this mountain. And he was like, I'm gonna go go peek it. If you want to come, come. If you don't, I totally understand. I'm like, no, I'll go. And so we went out of our way to peek this mountain. I think it was Madden Peak. And I remember we got up there, and this is my master's advisor. And I was just like, Grant, I want to be naked on top of this mountain. Will you take a picture of me in my underwear? And he was like, yeah, sure, dude. So I stripped down to my underwear, and he took a picture of me on top of this mountain. It was wonderful.
I am now learning that studying what you study is not boring at all.
No, it's great. And that's what's wonderful. I mean, you're driving through, you know, Western Colorado. 2 years ago, we were in Montana and Idaho. And you're just driving through these towns. It's remote, it's beautiful landscape. You're going through these little towns, eating at these, you know, small mom and pop places, having the most delicious food that you've ever eaten in your life. Unreal. It's a great time. And the work, the hard part of our work is collecting the data, because it's in these really rugged, remote, difficult to access areas. And so that's the hard part, but that's also like the greatest part of it all is getting to traverse that terrain. It's wonderful.
It's like en route, you stop for a second, you're like, whoa, wait, look over there. And you see 2 miles of nothing but caverns, forest, and mountains.
Oh, exactly like that. It's a wonderful thing. Another awesome moment. What was really cool is one of our study sites was around this mountain called Mount Hesperus, or we were scouting in this area, and there's this mountain called Mount Hesperus, which is a sacred mountaintop to the Navajo. I believe it's the Navajo in Colorado, and it marks like the northernmost extent of their territory. And so, like, you know, afterwards, I ended up doing all this research, and so you see this really cool landscape, and then you learn like the history and like the cultural significance and meaning behind it. What was really cool about this mountain, it was just breathtaking to be around it almost all of the time. And you see it, and then you learn that it marks their northern boundary. But what happened was Diné, who was like the spiritual ancestor, cultural hero figure of the Navajo, I believe it's the Navajo, was wandering through all the worlds. And then the world we exist in is the fourth world, and he comes into it, and he just lays down this giant mountain, and he shrouds it in a cover of blackness, and then shoots a rainbow out of it, and is like, this is the land of the Navajo. Don't fuck with it. And it's just like, whoa, I was there, and I hung out with there for like 2 weeks. It was great.
That is awesome.
Oh, yeah. And then also from on top of that mountain, you look into Utah and you can see Sleeping Ute Mountain, which looks like a Sleeping Ute Native American. And he's just like laying on the ground. You see his head, his folded arms, his legs. Oh, unreal. It was so great. And there was one night where you watched the sunset over him and there were some clouds. And then, you know, a streak of light broke from the sky and like just illuminated his forehead. Oh, it was wonderful. Yeah, you know what? You can totally call me a tree hugger because it was some of the greatest landscape in the world. Yeah, I get paid for this.
Yeah. I'm not going out and chaining myself to a tree saying, don't cut it down and put a parking lot in. No, I'm hiking some of the best country in the world.
Oh, yeah, and having and experiencing moments of just sheer and total existential bliss. So, yeah,
it's got to cool. Inform your writing somehow.
Oh, it totally does. Do we want to go down this path?
No, I figured, you know, we should at least remind our listeners that, no, we didn't just put a random geography person on the program this time.
Yeah, it totally does inform my writing. Almost all of my writing has to do with the landscape in some capacity, whether, you know, a lot of it just builds on the imagery of the shit I've seen. You know, I haven't written the West a lot because I've only been there for a few weeks out of the entirety of my life, but it's definitely informed my writing, but like, you know, the Appalachians for sure inform my writing, and I write about that a lot. Just using the imagery.
I gotta say, Chris, I am envious of you because in Florida there are no mountains, and I grew up in the mountains.
Yeah, that's gotta be tough.
It is. It's you know, the mountains to me, I don't want to get tree huggery or new agey or spiritual, but they do have some significance to me, some kind of spiritual significance to me.
Yeah, I mean, if you grow up with it, it's definitely impacted you in some manner. And if you've definitely, you know, engaged with, like, not engaged with the forest, but any landscape you engage or partake in definitely informs your being. So, and then if that's taken away from you, like, it's like, yeah, you have a total loss. Were you an outdoorsy much?
Not much, but, you know, I was a kid, so I could run up and down mountains and play in the woods there.
Right, yep.
And I miss that down in Florida because it's all flat land and where I am is pretty urbanized and strip mall.
Yeah, that's too bad.
So I don't get, I mean, I have beaches, but they're.
Yeah. And you know, like, you know, beaches are cool, but like, there's nothing, I don't know. There's nothing like a hilly landscape. That's one of my, that's another beef I have with like the Midwest. And people are like, oh, you know, town's hilly. This is hilly here. And I'm like, I don't know. Why don't you go down to the Southeast? And people are like, oh, I know what hills are. I've seen hills. Like, yeah, it's hilly here. I'm like, it's not the same. It's not hilly in the Midwest.
You know, 30 feet does not a hill make.
Right, yeah. You know, that's the thing, too. Like, a hill to me is like, or, you know, I mean, yeah, you know, you have your small inclinations across the rolling landscape, but unless it obscures my view, it has to obscure my view substantially. That's a hill.
Agreed. So, we're almost at the end here.
Really? Wow.
I know. I'm looking at the clock. I'm like, wow, we have been going at this for a while.
But I hope we covered some good ground.
I think we did, except that I have in my notes here, I'm like, you said you wanted to bring up an F-bomb story.
Oh, well, okay, real quick.
By all means, go ahead.
It's not even that funny. When we first moved to Tennessee, I have two older brothers. They're 10 and 7 years older than me, and they were very influential on me as a child. My mom, my dad as well, they all curse like, I don't know if they're going to get, like, upset with me for mentioning this. I don't think that they would. They all curse pretty heavily, especially my mom. My mom's favorite, she might not admit to. I don't, oh, my God, am I allowed to say this? Sorry, Mom. Hi, Mom. Love you, Mom. Her favorite sequencing is shit, fuck, piss. And she says shit, fuck, piss so much. And it's hilarious. And she especially uses it when she's driving. And there's another sequence that I don't even think I'm allowed to say. Like, I feel bad about saying it, so I'm not even going to say the other sequence she has. But she's got a terrible mouth. My brother's too. So, like, when I was 14, I was just dropping F-bombs. It was in my vernacular, you know. You know, fucking this, fucking that, you know, fuck. And, you know, I didn't do it because I was some, like, rambunctious, out of control, want to make a statement, you know, rebellious teen. I did it because, like, that's what I knew. Like, that's what I was informed by. I don't think it was a bad thing. It's just part of my vernacular. But it started bothering my mom really bad. One day she was like, all right, Chris, seriously, we're going to have to do this. I'm instituting an F jar. So every time you swear, you're putting a dollar in the jar. And I was like 15 at the time. And I was like, all right, whatever, you know. And then I tried to stop. And then, like, she couldn't keep – I didn't have enough money to put in the jar. So I didn't know what else to put in the jar. We couldn't do the F jar just because I said the F word so much. It's hilarious. That was a terrible story. It's not even that funny.
You start throwing random lint in there, you know.
Just whatever. Yeah, just putting paper clips and buttons. Like, I'm 16, right? I don't know what the fuck to put in here. I don't have money. What the fuck's money?
I've thought about maybe getting one for myself and instituting it because I grew up a New Yorker. I think and say the word motherfucker at least once an hour in my head.
Yep, totally. Motherfucker's a good one.
What is your favorite curse word?
You know what? Lately, I've been saying goddamn a lot. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that one on the show. Sorry if that was a no-no. But
we're ranked as explicit. I don't care what you say on the show.
All right. Well, yeah, I say GD a lot. Fuck is, yep, GD and fuck in all its variations. Would you say motherfucker's your go-to, or you just use it?
Mine is definitely shit.
Shit, yeah, it's so good. It's so variable.
It's a verb. It's a noun. It's an adjective, shitty. It can be an adverb. Shittily.
Yeah, that's, I've never used that.
The only thing I can't think it used can be used as is a conjunction. Yeah, it's an interjection with a, you know, yeah. You can be like shit with a comma. Shit, mm-hmm. I don't know what to do. Or shit.
We should try to figure out, maybe obviously we probably don't have enough time now, but we should part, we should definitely try to work it in as a conjunction, figure that one out.
Let's pose it to our listeners as well.
Yes, for sure.
How can you use shit as a conjunction? Let us know in our comments on our Facebook page or Twitter or wherever. Chris, speaking of the internet, how can folks at home find you?
Right. I am practically a Luddite, and I don't have Instagram. I don't have a smartphone. I don't have anything. But if you look me up on Facebook, is that cool? Can I tell people to do that?
Yep, you can do that.
Look me up on Facebook. Add me as a friend, willing to friend you. I have a can I do a couple plugs for my book and stuff?
By all means, I'd love you to do that.
Yeah. So this 2014 last year was a good year. I got my first chapbook published from the University of Indianapolis. So it's called Action at a Distance. And if you go to etchingspress.org, you can find that there. A lot of it has to do with the Northeast, Southeast, and Midwest. I'm writing the landscape a lot there. So you can do that. I have poems appearing in various journals across the internet. If you Google my name and poetry, there's some stuff on Connotation Press, Gingerbread House Literary Magazine, all that good stuff. And also, last plug, I am doing a reading at Forest to Shore Gallery in Stratford, Connecticut on February 1st. I will be opening for Buddy Wakefield for his Riled Up and Wasted on Light tour that evening. So I highly suggest everybody to check that out. Buddy Wakefield's fucking awesome and unreal. So if you're in the area, come see me read, but more importantly, come check out Buddy and add me on Facebook. So that's my shit.
That's cool. Well, we'll look for that and put it up there on the episode here and put the links up so people can be reminded of it.
Fantastic. Thanks, Scott.
Chris, it has been a pleasure talking with you as always.
Yeah, it's so good. It's good to talk to you, Sky. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, man. You are one hell of a fun dude with an awesome beard and some good stories.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that.
Hey, you take care of yourself now.
All right. See you, Scott.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.